Hi, this is Jeff Noble, and you're listening to the FASD Success Show. We got a great episode today. I've never done this sort of episode. It's an AMA. Ask me anything. I put it out there to the community. I got a bunch of questions asked, and I am going to answer them to the best of my ability. We're going to be talking about swearing. We're going to be talking about anxiety. We're going to be talking about what to tell other parents who are questioning your parenting. We're going to talk about toileting issues. We're going to talk about the importance of getting a diagnosis. We're going to talk about a lot of different things. And we're going to talk about it. So you asked, I'm going to answer. Let's get after it.
Welcome to the FASD Success Show, the only podcast where you can get real-world information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This show will help you create calm in the chaos, have hope for the future, and more importantly, save your sanity so you don't lose your flipping mind. Now, here's your host, caregiver turned world FASD educator, Jeff Noble.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to episode 112 of the FASD Success Show. I'm your host, Jeff Noble. It's great to be here with you today, whether this is your first show or your 112th show. I just appreciate you being here. I know how tough it is to be a caregiver. I know how tough the daily grind is. So the fact that you spend a little bit of time with me means a lot. Because you know, this podcast is all about creating success. It's about creating success in your home, in your life, with the individuals on the spectrum, people that work with the individuals on the spectrum, extended family, professionals, you name it. How do we do that? We do that by talking to some people who do some really great work and are just a big part of the FASD community. But we have no guest. Okay. So I wasn't here last week. We didn't put out a podcast because something happened and we weren't able to. And then I said, you know what? Let's change it up then. This is an opportunity to do a Q&A and ask me anything. Because why not try to switch things up? When something happens, you got to go with the flow. And so that's what we did. So I put some questions. I put the, you know, the ask out to my community. We have a private Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/FASD forever. Got about 4,500 people in there. So if you're not in our group yet, you could join it. But for this story, I asked folks in the group if they had any questions that I would answer. And I also, because we do have a newsletter, we do send out emails, and I asked there. I didn't realize we got a lot of questions. We got so many questions, in fact, I was like, we might have to do several episodes. So we whittled the questions down as many as we can because there was some overlap. People were asking similar questions. And then I waited a week because I didn't just want to jump in. There was some questions that were asked that I wanted to reach out to some of the real experts, right? Like the researchers and the doctors to get their answers. So I can give you the most updated information from what the research is saying on a few items. So last week was your chance to catch up, and I apologize for not putting one out. You know, we're just a small group here, just a small group doing our best. And sometimes for whatever reason, there won't be a podcast. And other times I'll tell you I'm taking a scheduled break because sometimes I need one, but now is not one of those times. So before we get into it, I just wanted to stress, if you like what we're doing here, by all means, please subscribe to the show. It helps us. It helps you. It helps you because you get, as soon as we have a new episode drop, it drops right into your electronic devices. And it helps us because it lets people know who are searching for FASD information that our show is credible and relevant and is going to help them out. So however you listen to the show, Spotify, iTunes, Podbean, BeanPod, pod plastic pod I don't know, however you do it, subscribe, it helps us out a lot. Okay, cool. Okay, so before we get into this, I do honestly, I have a disclaimer. So I'm going to be answering these questions, and if anybody's ever done some live training with me or the folks who are a part of our online coaching program know that this is my disclaimer. I am not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a social worker. I'm not a psychologist. I haven't spent a single class in medical school, okay? It's just super important. Do I have some education? Yep. I got years and years of lived experience with not only foster kids, my own family, and I got some great education, was part of the first FASD certificate program from the Child Welfare Institute, from the Toronto Children's Aid Society. And I've been able to travel the world and do teachings and trainings and talk to 1,000 professionals. And, you know, you just listen to the podcast. So that's where I'm coming from, my own real experience and what I've heard, what I've read, from my understanding. And I just think that's important to put out there. Don't take what I'm saying as gospel. Take it with a grain of salt. In fact, do your own extended research. That's just, please, because nobody knows everything about FASD. I don't know about your kids, your situation. So my answers are going to be kind of general about the disability itself, what it could be, what could be happening, what you might want to consider. But at the end of the day, you are the expert on your kid. So I'm just trying to give a little bit of insight. Right, that is my positioning, is you are the expert and I am the advisor, and I'm just trying to give you some feedback from what I know about the disability. So there's no bio, it's me today, and I'm going to answer as many questions as humanly possible, and hopefully that you like it. And I would love to know your feedback if you liked it at the end of the show, jeff@fasdforever.com. And just let me know, because we might make it a thing, or you could be like, dude, stick to just interviewing the experts, because yowzers. So whatever the case may be. So I don't know about you, but if you're ready, I'm pretty ready. All right, let's go. All right, everybody, here I am with me. It's just me. Well, that's right. All right, let's get to the questions. Question number one. This question comes from the Facebook group, from Amy. Do you think we need an FASD diagnosis? Yes. All right, next question. I'm just kidding, there's more. My boys have several other diagnoses, including ID, that gets a service, etc. They are adopted, and we have confirmed prenatal drug use for the younger. We have a good relationship with a bio sister who is 10 years old and might be able to get confirmation of alcohol exposure from her. We haven't found a doctor who will diagnose them yet, but haven't really pushed either. A genetics doctor gave them a static encephalopathy diagnosis. Just wondering how important it is to have the official diagnosis. I'm not sure it would get us more help, but I'm pretty certain that they are on the spectrum. Amy, thank you so much for the question. Okay, so there's a few parts here, and I'm also going to back it up with some expert audio. So to answer your question, yes. I do think it's very important to get a FASD diagnosis, but not really for the reasons that you're stating in terms of getting support in your case specifically, because it does sound like you have some because of the ID diagnosis. But I think you need to look at this a different way. I believe that it is important to get a diagnosis for your boys so that your boys know that it's not because of them. Right, it is their brain, it isn't their personality. You know who answered this really well was in episode 55. Her name is Dr. Valerie Temple, and she runs the adult FASD diagnostic clinic. It's called the Surrey Place. It's in Toronto. And so I asked her this same question about, is it important to get a diagnosis at any age? And here's just a really quick answer, and then I'll come back.
Diagnosis, I always say diagnosis can be transformative. It can really change people's lives. It can help you to understand things that were invisible to you before. It can help you to kind of make a roadmap and plan for the future. And it can make you understand what you didn't before about why these things happen.
Both for the caregiver, the families, and the individual. So it becomes a part of the healing process. So absolutely. Now the individual's like, it's my brain, it's not my character. Because I believe everybody has those needs to be loved and contribute.
One of the most powerful things I ever heard was we did a study of long-term follow-up after diagnosis. So we looked at this group of adults that had gotten a diagnosis as adults. And we wanted to know, you know how Anne Streisguth in her kind of seminal article talked about, you got to get a diagnosis before 6 years old, and that's going to, you know, be a really good thing. Yeah. But, you know, I firmly believe that getting a diagnosis at any age is important. And we wanted to look at, so what happens if you get an adult diagnosis? How is that for you? And one of the most powerful things that I heard was from one of the guys. He talked about, you know, we asked him, what is it like? You know, did you think it was a good idea to get a diagnosis? And he said, it was the best thing ever because I learned that I'm not crazy or stupid. and it's not my fault. And that's, you know, you don't realize how much guilt people are walking around with as well, that this is my fault that I'm not succeeding. This is my fault that I'm...
And that was Dr. Valerie Temple, episode 55. You can go and listen to it. She says more about it. But doesn't that make sense? It's less about the services. It's more about the individual themselves, understanding themselves. And that, you know, because they've been trying so hard for so many years and say, wait a minute, it's not me. It's my brain. And that's something I can manage. I remember back in the day, Diane Melvin telling me about an individual they told that was on the spectrum. And the person said, geez, it's good to know that I'm not the problem, that I have a problem. And I know maybe the language is suspect, but that's what the person said. So isn't that true? So yes, it's important. Get that diagnosis. And, you know, there are ways to get a diagnosis without prenatal confirmation. It could listen to the rest of that episode because they'll tell you. It could come from confirmation, come from mom or a reliable source. Or if it's in the social history, if you go to a good clinic, a lot of times they're half investigator as well. So yes, I don't care what age, get it. I know folks who've gotten it at 6, and I know individuals who've gotten it at 60. It allows them to understand why they do the things that they do and to let them know that there's also things that they could do to manage that. So again, go back through my podcast, listen to any individual on the spectrum talk about how important a diagnosis is, especially if it's well into their adult life. So I hope that answered the question. Thanks, Amy, for that. I appreciate it. All right, here we go. Question number 2. Hello, Jeff. My question is, what are you hearing or what are your thoughts about neurofeedback in terms of treating FASD? Peace and joy, Josh. P.S. Bonus question. Greatest Maple Leaf to ever play. Ooh. Okay, so if you don't know, folks, I'll answer the latter question first. I am a massive hockey fan. I do love the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I would say the greatest Toronto Maple Leaf to ever to play is Austin Matthews. He is currently playing right now. He just got 60 goals. He won the Hart Trophy. He's amazing. But my second, as I was growing up, would have been Matt's Sundin. So there we go. Those are, you get a bonus. You get two of my favorite Maple Leaf hockey players. All right, now on to neurofeedback. I actually do have some thoughts on neurofeedback. Now, I will tell you this. I do read about, you know, it comes up in my group once in a while, how people have seen benefits. Other people have seen no benefits, and it's really expensive. So what I did is, I'm going to play another clip. I don't do this for every question. I think this is the last one, but just it's important to bring in an expert here. But for me personally, to the countless of research that I've read, that I've been presented with, that comes across my desk at a conference, and I've never heard somebody stand up and say or present in an FASD conference that there was good science for neurofeedback. If there was, I would have heard about it, I swear to you, but I haven't. And so I don't think, again, if you've had success, great. There could be other contributing factors to this, but I don't think so. I don't think so. So like Wikipedia says neurofeedback, also called neurotherapy, is a type of feedback that presents real-time feedback from brain activity in order to reinforce healthy brain function through operant conditioning. Okay. Again, I have never heard of this. It hasn't crossed my desk. I haven't heard of it from CanFASD, the NIH, none of that. So what I did, though, is I remember asking in one of my podcasts, episode 26, I asked a doctor. His name is Dr. Jeff Wozniak out of the University of Minnesota. We were talking about choline, but about treatment, choline, the treatment, but I was asking about neurofeedback. And this is what he said. So I think it's an excellent answer. Can't really say it better myself. We'll play it and we'll just come back. So this is Dr. Jeff Wozniak about neurofeedback.
I hear neurofeedback come up often. I know you're not an expert in that, but is there any science in your professional, personal opinion on the effect of that therapy?
Well, I'll say a couple things about it. In general, yes, parents need to be aware that there are a lot of treatments or interventions for which the science is not very specific or is non-existent. So either the science doesn't exist or it doesn't specifically apply to what their child may have. So, you know, and these things range across everything you can imagine, having all kinds of different interventions. So that's a general statement, that you need to be skeptical of interventions in general, and look for, you know, actual evidence. One of the hallmarks of a treatment that is problematic is if it applies to too many conditions, be skeptical of that. So, for example, choline applies, we think, very specifically within a time window of the first couple of years of life. Right. And we're not saying that it's going to affect a child's learning disabilities, you know, their reading disorder. And we're not saying it's going to change their likelihood of developing schizophrenia, and it's going to affect their gastrointestinal health. You know, it's a specific targeted intervention, and that's based on specific tests of that theory. So I would say, if you're looking at treatments that are out there, evaluate how broadly they're being advertised. And if they're being advertised very broadly for everything from ADHD to learning disabilities to behavior to depression to anxiety to tics to emotional problems, then my skepticism level goes up when I see too much of a cure-all type phenomenon. I think that's a good general strategy for parents mm-hmm. to take.
That's excellent.
Yeah. The other thing that I would say about neurofeedback, biofeedback, techniques that basically train a person to be in touch with some bodily system. And that's essentially what the feedback part of those things are involving, is that potentially there are benefits to that. So like biofeedback, for example, is teaching people to learn through an electrical device what's happening with their muscles. And it could be muscles in the scalp or muscles in the neck, for example, muscles in the jaw. And so people can learn, for example, to take control of those muscles, those automatic muscles, and to reduce the tension in their jaw so that they don't grind their teeth as much or have problems with TMJ or other kinds of jaw pain. So there is a very real benefit from doing feedback, of being aware of bodily functions that you're not normally aware of by using some sort of an electrical measure of that. With the brain, it's so much more complicated. Mm-hmm. It's not a muscle, and it's extremely complex in terms of what's happening there. So, you know, I think it's a much harder thing to do, and it's a much harder thing to demonstrate. And again, I would look for specificity, very, very clear.
That guy's the man, plain and simple, Jeff Wozniak, Dr. Jeff Wozniak. I think he said it way better than I could. That's why I put the clip in here. We have to be careful. You have to be careful. And I get it, okay? You want something to work, anything to work, to make things better. But you also need to know that there are people who are in this for a business and are looking to generate revenue. And because of that, now I'm not saying all clinics are like that, but just be careful. I did hear a statistic at one time that it costs families an extra $20,000 a year over and above on medications and therapies. And so that could have just saved you a lot of money in doing that. But you do what you want, right? Because you are the parent. But the evidence isn't there. I haven't seen it even when we've gone looking for it. So please, please be careful with that. Please be careful, okay? And if somebody says, oh, there is science and there is, well, make sure that it's in a respectable peer-reviewed journal, that if somebody's showing you that. I just want to make sure that you guys are protected. But that was a great question, Josh. Also about the Leafs. Go Leafs, go. Next year's their year. So thank you very much for that. All right, moving on. Next question. Oh, this is a two-parter. That's okay. We'll let it slide. This is from Eloise. Eloise says, FASD, in all of your interviewing of adults, young adults on the spectrum with FASD, what are Jeff Noble's top two takeaways, your learnings, she bolded these, about what adults with FASD want us, the people who support them, to understand? Great question. I have had the absolute privilege in my travels with this podcast, at conferences, over, you know, with our online coaching course, to just to speak to a lot of individuals. And to answer your question, Eloise, my number one takeaway is for every successful adult that I have ever interviewed, there was a parent or parents or somebody that did not give up on them no matter how tough it got. I can give you a couple examples, like call it Phil Cox, who, you know, as a young person even was in the streets and was homeless. It was meeting her mom. It's documented in the well-known book, Damaged Angels at McDonald's, that her parents did not give up. So when she was ready, when she was able, when it was time, that she did end up getting her own place. Like she ended up moving. I forget what the number of podcast was. You could go to fasdsuccess.com/podcast. There's a search bar. If you're on the desktop, it's at the top. If you're on your mobile, it's at the bottom, and you could just put in Colette. So she succeeded. I know that there was also Matthew Pacozzi, Bill Blair. There's just an assortment of individuals. That is my number one, that somebody did not give up on them. Now, that doesn't mean that the parents didn't have boundaries and, you know, there wasn't a hill that they weren't going to die on, but always staying connected. So like Colette's mom came to visit her when she was still on the street, just to keep that connection alive. So that is the number one, that there's somebody that did not give up on them, no matter how hard it got. My two takeaways. The second takeaway is that individuals on the spectrum are just as frustrated with themselves as you are with them. I'm not going to play the clip, but if you want to go listen to my interview with Maggie May, she just talked about how after a meltdown, how she felt so remorseful and guilty and shame, because nobody wants to lose control. Nobody wants to be like that. Nobody wants to be outed. I know people say, they're just doing these behaviors because they're looking for attention. No way, Jose. It's not attention they're looking for. It's actually support. So when you reframe it that way, you can see it's much better, and then you'll interact way differently. But absolutely, they feel guilty. And then to talk down to them or try and take things away, it just doesn't work. They already feel like crap. This is why we need to work on skill building. But those are my two takeaways. One, never give up on an individual. Number two, they feel just as frustrated with themselves as you do with them. They want to get it right. They want to do well. And you know what? Here's a bonus one, that individuals, given the right accommodation and an environment, can do well. They can do good. They're good people. They're funny. They're sweet. I have several who are my friends, and I tell a story about being a friend with an adult, my buddy RJ Formanuk, and how I even forget sometimes, and I have to remind myself to accommodate, because sometimes I get him worked up. I don't mean to, but I get so excited and I forget, because he is my buddy, and that he looks normal, talks normal, and he's incredible, but still he has some challenges. So those are the bonus ones, I guess. Oh, you have a question too here. Why is it important to understand and respect that no two individuals on the spectrum are the same? In other words, why does understanding spectrum matter when we want to be the best assistance to our loved ones? Okay, so that's true. No two individuals are the same. Just because you know one person on the spectrum means you just know one person. Why is it important? Because every individual on the spectrum are going to need their own support and their own accommodations in their own way. Sure, do we have stuff, blanket statements, blanket strategies like support and structure and environment? We do have that routine. Those are general blanket statements, but you need to know who the individual is first as a human being, because they're human beings. They're not just a disability. They're not a word. They're not a phrase. They are human beings with feelings and thoughts and wants and desires and hopes and dreams. So it's important to understand, because even if you have two kids, the interventions and accommodations you use on one kid are totally different than the other kid. I remember sitting in a school one time. I was working with this young man. And I was in the office because this kid was being truant and they just weren't doing a very good job. And I was trying to advocate. And so I remember the principal saying, well, Jeff, so-and-so's brother also had FASD and we just had A, B, and C and it worked. Do the same thing for him. Well, he didn't understand that it does not work. It does not work. Every individual needs it unique. So if you have multiple kids that you're a parent or you're working with or you're working for, whatever the case may be, they're different people. Their brain has been impacted differently. Even if you're twins, do you know that? You can have a twin who has FASD. You can have a twin who doesn't have FASD. People are different. The impact of the prenatal alcohol exposure on the brain at different times, different places, different. So that is why. That is why no two individuals are the same. And that's why it's important to understand, because they need their individualized accommodations because they are individuals. I have accommodations that help me get through the day. It's not the same accommodations that my wife has to get her through the day. It's just different. So I think that's why. So thanks for asking, Eloise. You're a rock star. All right, next question. Here we go. Okay. Hi, Jeff. I really appreciate this email. I do have a question for you. Is it common for children, individuals with FASD, to have bowel accidents on a frequent basis? Yes. My granddaughter is 9, and we are still having troubles. My BC from Reach had suggested Blackbird toileting service. The support worker came over a few times and spent time with our daughter. The concept is to reward instantly with when the child goes on the toilet. I have been told that rewards don't work with FASD children. Okay, I'm going to talk about this generally. So to answer your question, who is this? Sorry. Barbara Ann, to answer your question, yes, it is very common for individuals on the spectrum to have toileting issues, to have elimination issues, to have bowel issues. So what I want to do is run down a few reasons as to why that may be. One, they're too young. So one thing, a primary disability, primary symptom and a direct result for prenatal alcohol exposure for some of individuals on the FASD spectrum is dysmaturity. Now, dysmaturity is not like immaturity. Immaturity suggests that you can still act in a manner compatible with your age. Dysmaturity means the individual on the spectrum is functioning at a age younger than their chronological age. So it is stage, not age. So while in this case, Barbara Ann, your daughter might be chronologically 9, but developmentally, she could be much, much younger. And that goes for the rest of you. Your kid could be, usually kids learn to toilet at around 4 years old, right? Between 3 and 4 years old. Developmentally, your children might be younger, so developmentally they're on par. So if they're like 6, they might only be 3. So developmentally, they're just not prepared to toilet train. Okay. There's also a sensory. It could be a sensory issue. There is something called introception. Okay. When it comes to sensory issues, and we know that a lot of our guys have sensory issues, there's proprioception, but there's interception. And interception is a lesser known sense that helps you understand and feel what's going on inside your body. Right? I got this from understood.org. Kids who struggle with interoceptive sense may have trouble knowing when they feel hungry, full, hot, cold, thirsty. Right from the article, it says interception helps you understand and feel what's going on inside your body. For instance, you know if your heart is beating fast or if you need to breathe more deeply. You're able to tell if you need to use the bathroom. You know if you're hungry, full, hot, cold, thirsty, nauseated, itchy, or ticklish. For kids with sensory processing issues, the brain may have trouble making sense of that information. They may not be able to tell when they're feeling pain or when their bladder is full. So that could be one reason. Another reason is it could be a side effect from medication. Okay. Another reason it could be is from trauma. The idea of going to the bathroom scares them. There's also, I got this from the Canadian Psychological Association. There are some conditions that are called enuresis and incompresis. gosh, I don't know why, but it's like pooping and peeing, okay? So enuresis means urinating where you shouldn't in bed or in clothing, and capresis means defecating where you shouldn't in the clothes on the floor. Some of the risk factors could be lack of toilet training, although some children seem to learn without being taught. Many need someone to clearly teach them how to use a toilet. And same thing with individuals with FASD. They need people to show them how to do these skills. It could be stress, right? They could have a new brother or sister. They could have moved placements. They could be in a new daycare. They could have constipation. It could be hard to poop. Or they could have pain when they're pooping. You know, there's eating too much, junk food, not enough fiber, not drinking enough liquids, family history of it too. It could be passed on, bladder infections, and a distractibility. A distracted child may not listen to their body telling them that they need to pee or poo. And of course, there could be anxiety about toilets, germs, bathrooms, or even separation from mom or dad. So what we don't want to do, what we don't want to do is we don't want to shame them. We don't want to shame them because, like, as I look into this article, it says it in very bold letters. It is important to know that children almost never wet or soil their clothes to upset you. Most children would rather be able to use the toilet properly, and I totally believe that. So, and there are some people that can help with that, absolutely. But in this case, what I was just reading for this question, the concept is to reward instantly. I would look at all of the internal factors before I went and started doing behavior modification. I would look at all the things we just talked about and look at your lovelies, their functioning. I know your granddaughter's 9, but she might not be 9. And who knows? I don't know how long she's been with you, but there could be some trauma. There could be a lot of other factors going on. So what I jump to the rewarding someone, sure, I'd always high five somebody after a good poop, but I wouldn't use the shame or blame. I would just take a look at it, Barbara Ann, that's all I'm telling you. And I know parents that are struggling with it to this day, and there's not a lot of research about incontinence with FASD specifically, so you know I'm gonna get on the team about that. But I hope that answered your question. We don't want to shame them. They don't want to feel shame about that. Everybody wants to poop and pee on their own, and I know sometimes our guys get impulsed or they forget. Sometimes our guys miss the bathroom. So I have instructed or have suggested to some of the parents that I work with that if they're either missing the toilets or they're not getting up in time, to either, you might even have to wake them up, or in the morning when they go pee, you got to watch, even though you think they're at the stage and the age where they should be able to do it on their own. Lots of reasons and lots of investigating that needs to go on, but I don't know about the rewards. If they're still struggling at 9, I would assume that something's going on, or they're biologically or psychologically. So have a look at that. So thanks for the question. I know lots of people deal with that. It's a shitty situation. I couldn't help myself. I could not help myself with a dad joke. I'm using levity, but I know it's awful because I hear about it all the time. Okay, here we go. The next question is from Lisa. Lisa says, my teenage son curses a lot. His father and I have tried to talk with him about it, but he does not seem to understand. He cursed at another student at school, and I got an email from his teacher. Is cursing common with FASD? Is there anything I could do to help him understand that cursing is not appropriate? His father and I do not curse in the home, and it is concerning that he is using foul language. Thank you. Well, Lisa, I'm telling you what, cursing is, anybody who's listening to this right now knows that if you are working with or living with or raising an individual on the spectrum, you will get cursing. Okay, here's the deal, man. Cursing, it's a little bit more complicated than that, okay? There's a few things going on, and I've assembled some information for you guys. And of course, everything that I'm using as a source, I'm going to put it in our blog post as well. Okay, so here we go. Okay, so in order to look at swearing, where do we have to start. We always start with the brain, okay? There's not a lot of research on FASD and swearing either. So when we dug deep, this is what we found. I found this from howstuffworks.com, actually, about swearing. And it says, swearing in the brain. Your brain is a very complex organ, but there are only a few things you need to know about it to understand how it approaches swear words differently from other language. So swearing is different from other language. In most people, the left hemisphere of your brain is in charge of language. The right hemisphere creates the emotional content of language. Language processing is a higher brain function that takes place in the cerebral cortex. Whoa, back up. So what do I mean by that? Okay, this is what I mean by that. So most language is the left hemisphere of your brain, and language involves the higher process, your executive functioning, your prefrontal cortex. It is the youngest part of our brain in terms of evolution, okay? But they're saying that many studies suggest that the brain processes swearing in the lower regions, along with emotion and instinct. Scientists theorize that instead of processing a swear word as a series of units of sound that must be combined to form a word, the brain stores swear words as a whole unit, so the brain doesn't need the left hemisphere help to process them. Swearing specifically involves the limbic system. And if you've ever been to one of my training, if you've been involved in my online coaching course, if you've ever listened to this podcast, we talk about the limbic system, which also houses memory, emotion, and basic behavior. The limbic system is at the base of the brain. It also seems to govern vocalizations in primates and other animals, and some researchers have interpreted some primate vocalizations as swearing. So you can think of swearing as a motor activity with an emotional component. Okay, what does that mean? So swearing comes from the base of your brain, the limbic system, your fight or flight. It is stored in there as a whole, as a unit. So it's quicker and it's easier to access. And it's a motor activity with an emotional component. It's the emotional stuff that we have issues with. Okay, so there's a great PDF that we got. It is from the National Association of Therapeutic Parents, the Center of Excellence in Childhood Trauma. And the PDF is titled "What the Fuck? Why Children Swear and How to Deal with It." And so it's not so much about the act, about how it makes us feel, right? They mentioned that, you know, when you get sworn at, it makes you feel belittled, you're under attack, that you're hated, violated, disrespected, scared, out of control. So it's our own experience. We may have memories of swearing, and we may be thinking that we would never have spoken to our parents like that, and yet let alone hear our kids doing that. So we have to understand our triggers. What are triggering us? Why do we get so triggered when somebody swears? Diane Melbin talks about values clashes, right? So there's the reason why you can get triggered is because of social expectations, like swearing in public, swearing in front of grown-ups. Swearing is not in some social settings, it's not acceptable. It is not something you do. So then you're worried about judgment from others, from other family members, other friends, even maybe fellow siblings. So there's the judgment, right? There's fear. There's fear that we could feel very fearful that despite all that we're doing, it'll never make a difference. That, you know, the language classes and the multiple times that I'm repeating and ask them not to, you get scared. And then you say, like, I didn't sign up for this. You know, I didn't sign up for a kid to be so disrespectful for me, to abuse me like this. And then what ends up happening is we become dysregulated, right? That's what happens. We become dysregulated. So it's also important to know that swearing comes from a different area of the brain, right? The primal area of the brain. Like for example, like, have you ever stubbed your toe? Have you ever stubbed your toe? Are you using like intricate language? No, you're swearing, right? Because you're regulating yourself because it hurts. You're not using your higher order functioning. You're going, ah, shit, ah, ah. Oh, son of a, and you're doing your thing because you're regulating yourself, and you're not going, oh, my toe, it has hit the door, and so now it is throbbing, and I'm in pain, and I'm uncomfortable. Whatever shall I do? You don't do that when you swear, right? There's other reasons that your loved one could swear. They don't understand the language. It has been the language of their lives to date. If you have a kid who's in a new placement, if you swear, also they're experiencing a trauma memory and they're showing you what life was like for them, that things are out of control and this is what they've seen back home. They think it's a surefire way of getting attention. And what I mean by attention is they need that support. Sometimes, and I know this happened to my sister, it's used as proof that you're tough. It is a defensive mechanism because nobody is looking at your ability to function or your adaptive skills. It is like, this person is a tough, right? There's also a lack of a social filter, impulse control issues. They don't think before they speak. I heard a mom one time say FAS means filter absent syndrome. So what can we do, right? It's hard. It's not good. It could take you by surprise. It could feel you could take it personal. Ooh, my buddy RJ actually said, you know, we might be swearing at you, but it's not about you. There's some things you could do. Pause, reconnect your brain, check yourself before you wreck yourself. It's only words. I know it's upsetting, but it's at the end of the day, it is only words and they're not being physical. That's what we need to really understand is that it could be a traumatic experience for them as well. This is where you need self-care. This is where you need to depersonalize it. And how do you help them? By having conversations when they're regulated. This is where teaching self-regulation skills really, really come into play here. Always correcting, but not shaming, because, you know, they go right into their fight or flight. That is what they do. And it is hard for them to access that higher order of critical thinking and expressive language. So that's, you know, that's the theories that's going out there. So everybody deals with it. I know most of our folks deal with it. It's just, we need to approach it a little bit different and try not to take it so flippant personal. Okay. Oh my gosh. What time? Oh, we're trucking and I'm only this far in. Oh my gosh. Okay. Here we go. Next question. This one's from Kathleen. Kathleen says, any plans for a day or weekend meet in Canada, like a workshop? Thank you. A short answer is any planned? No. Have I been hired to do a few trainings throughout Canada before the end of the year? Yes. While I am not planning anything for Canada, between me and you, I am planning something for the United States of America. In the future, absolutely. But one of the things the pandemic taught me was, you know, we could do a lot of things from Zoom, right? We could do a lot of things from home and parents don't have to travel and get childcare and all of those sort of things. But short answer is no. I do also work with about 145 families who, you know, take our online coaching program. So we do, you know, I'm pretty busy every single day, in fact, with that stuff. Is it out of the realm of possibility? No, it's not. But is it going to be something that I am personally going to be putting together for an in-person weekend or workshop? No, I am not. And I apologize for that. I'm going to try either late this year, early next year to do one in the United States of America. But of course, in October, we will have our online caregiver Kickstart workshop, which is free. It goes on for about a week. It's digital and it'll happen either the end of October, early November. So Kathleen, thanks for the question. Maybe in the future, not now, US first, because I've promised some people to do that. And we have a lot of caregivers in our little group that are from the US. And I think it is time, though. It is time to get together. And I can't wait to see their faces. Some of them have been working with me since the pandemic, before the pandemic, and to get a chance to see them will be great. Okay, let's keep rocking and rolling. Rock and roll, Paw Patrol. What's next? Hi, Jeff. My name is Heather. I'm 24 years old, and I have a guardianship of my younger sister, 22. Oh, wow. She has FASD, and life has been an incredible struggle. I do have a couple of questions that I've been pondering for years. Well, Hopefully I can give you some insight. Why is it that some seem to be more capable of living a relatively normal and healthy life while others, such as my sister, struggle in all aspects of life? Friendships, inappropriate relationships, can't do basic math, can't remember to keep healthy, personal hygiene, and more. Our mother wasn't in any better shape when I was born, so why is it that I seem to not hold the FASD diagnosis? I've had some learning struggles growing up, but think that was all chucked up to poor education in my early years. The question, if you choose to read this far, is it common for siblings or otherwise to feel a sense of survivor's guilt? I have always found myself feeling so guilty for not struggling like she does. I wish that it was more me and not her. Seeing her want a family and a home and to drive a car pains me because I know that a lot of that is out of reach. Thank you for taking the time to read this. Well, Heather, thank you. So for being 24 years old and having guardianship of your sister, that is amazing. And I am sorry that she is struggling. But, you know, to answer your question, is it common for siblings or otherwise to feel a sense of survivor's guilt? Well, sure. But actually what you're feeling is something that is normal, and that's called grief and loss. There are a lot of losses associated with FASD, like you just said, right? That she wants a family and a home and to drive and all those things. But having it like that might not be possible. And so those are all losses, and you can see how much she struggles, and you love her. So you might want to speak to a grief counselor, actually. You know, Heather, do what you want. You are the expert on you. But I think it's important to know that she is lucky to have you. And I would think it's also important to remember that if she didn't have you, she would probably be struggling a lot more. So I would definitely look at grief and loss, especially with FASD, and you know, give yourself a little bit of grace in that you can help her the best that you can, right? And you could do what you can for her. But it's true, man. There's twins, even twins. I think I mentioned this before in the episode that one twin could have FASD and the other one might not be able to have FASD. And I get the survivor's guilt. I don't have confirmation, but I'm pretty sure that one, if not both of my siblings are on the spectrum of some sort, and I see how they struggle with life. So what I do for me personal is like, okay, where can I help? How can I help? Who can I help? So instead of feeling bad and sad about, you know, my own siblings' situation, I can turn that and say, okay, where can I help? Who can I help? And that's what I've done. I've used what's happened to me and in my family and my experience to help others around me, and that makes it better. It makes it better. So where are you going to focus that energy? And I would put some work into grief and loss, because I did, and the parents that I work with, we go through it. It's never going to go away. It'll come at you in waves, but you'll be able to, when you understand grief and loss, you'll be able to see that wave coming, and you'll be able to ride that wave, and you won't be blindsided by it to knock you over. So kudos for you to have guardianship at the age of 24. Just keep loving on your sister and keep doing your best to support her. Don't give up on her. And again, look into grief and loss work, because that's not easy, man. And you're doing a great job. Keep it up. Thanks for the question. Okay. We're pushing an hour. I'll do a couple more. But there's a lot more. Let me know if you like this, because I could do another episode of this. But if you don't like it, then we won't. You get it. Okay. Hi. Is aggression in young adults with FASD to be expected? What we are seeing seems like more than just a widening gap with peers. At 15, 16, we thought her future held employment, driving, college. By 17, 18, we understood college and driving were not in the cards. We did a social graduation. At 19, she seems helpless in most domains of life. Skills she once had, for example, using a can opener or gone, she struggles with 6 to 12 hours a week with employment. It is sometimes hard to figure out can't versus won't, particularly when we are dealing with an average to high average IQ. We are beginning to wonder if we need to look for a group home to allow for some measure of independence. Thank you, Emily. Okay, Emily. So is regression in young adults with FASD to be expected? Yes, especially in the pandemic. This has come, I remember in the middle of the pandemic talking to Dr. Mansfield Mella, there can be regression. What it seems like more than just a widening gap with peers. At 15, we thought her future held employment, driving, and college. We understood that driving were not in the cards. Yeah, okay, so she struggled with 6 to 12 hours a week of employment. It is hard to figure out can't versus won't, but I'll tell you, I don't think there's a lot of won't. You know, it goes back to Dr. Ross Green when he says, if kids can, they will. If people can, they will. Like, get out of their way. I think a lot of what might be happening with you is your expectations of what you think she should be doing at this time. I mean, for example, skills she once had, for example, using a can opener, are gone. That could be because of, as her brain developed, things changed. I would definitely have her see an occupational therapist. That could be something more than just a loss of a skill. It could be an indication of something else. It could, you know, individuals on the spectrum have trouble with fine and gross motor skills, and that could definitely be one of them. If she struggles with 6 to 12 hours, weeks of employment, you know, they say a full-time job for a grown individual on the spectrum is about 20 hours. So she's doesn't seem too far off of that. Listen, if an individual isn't doing something, you know, one of the things that I've heard and I like to reiterate is non-compliance equals non-competence. If they aren't doing something, it's because they're not competent in that without support. Anybody could do anything with enough support. But when left on their own to do it without the skills to do it. And then you talked about when we were dealing with a high average, like an average to high IQ. IQ has nothing to do with this. There are 10 brain domains. This has everything to do with adaptive functioning, her daily living skills. How can she go through a day and make it through a day? Adaptive functioning. So they could have average to above average IQs. You have different IQs, right? You have an IQ, that's what you know. And then you have an executive function IQ, and that is what you do with what you know. And often individuals can have normal to average IQs, but have really low executive functioning IQs. It was taught to me that if you have good executive functioning, that means you'll be a good adult, right? You'll be able to hold down a job, pay your bills, plan for the future, organize, sequence, all that stuff to be a good adult. And that's where our guys suffer, you know, in the area of functioning, that executive function, that prefrontal cortex area of the brain. Now, if you're wondering if you need to look for a group home to allow for some sort of measure of independence, well, if you're looking for interdependence, maybe. But how old is she really, right? At 19, she's 19, but how old is she really? And you said she seems helpless in most domains of life. Well, the domains of life could just be one domain. That's adaptive functioning. You know, when you get a diagnosis, part of the criteria is they do look in your brain domains. In the United States and other parts of the world, it's 9 brain domains they look at. In Canada and other that use the Canadian diagnostic guidelines, it's 10 brain domains. In order to have one of the criteria for a diagnosis is deficits in 3 of those brain domains. And again, I've told the story 1,000 times, but when Dr. Jocelyn Cook, who is coming, they were creating the new diagnostic guidelines, they wanted to see when they were looking at data from the Canadian data form, they could look at anonymously from data from clinics that from clinics across Canada, and they wanted to see, was the psychologist looking at all 10 brain domains or did they stop because testing is extensive and expensive? And what they found was 66% of individuals that they looked at had deficits in 7 to 9 of their brain domains. So that's up to you about a group home for some sort of independence. But does she just need some time to cook, man, to develop, to learn some of these skills, or in your case, to recapture some of these skills? She might need an occupational therapist to work on her motor skills, her self-regulation, all of those things. It is a myriad, but to get to know how she's functioning, where she's functioning, and what kind of accommodations we can implement to help her function better. And if that means a group home for interdependence, then by all means. But she might just need some more time to develop. Certainly don't expect our kids to be leaving at 19 years of age. That is for sure. Wow. Okay. So I'm going to stop there because it's almost an hour and I don't want to sit here and bore you if this is an absolute catastrophe. So I'll tell you what. So those were questions I picked at random that were sent to me. I do have a lot more, but again, I want to respect your time. FASD is tough, man. But one of the things I'll say is it's important to get to know your kid as an individual, and then how does the disability affect them to manage daily, right? And it's not always easy, and it could be scary and frustrating, and sometimes it could seem like the professionals don't even know the answer, or they have no clue what's going on. They give you bad advice. There's lots of bad advice, wrong advice, but remember, brain first, brain first, brain first. You have a tough job. You have the hardest job on the planet doing this, and I salute you, and I commend you, and I respect you, and that's why it's important to stay within a community. That's why it's important to not give up. This is, I think, one of the things to say is that this is the long game. This is a long game. So just like Emily was talking about her 19-year-old daughter, what about when she turns 30? What about when she turns, you know, 25? She could develop so much between 19 and 25. It just... they can have success. Individuals on the spectrum can have success. It just looks different and it takes a lot longer. You know, if you have a younger kid, think stretch toddler, right? That's especially with the incontinence issue. They might just not be ready to toilet train or have the ability to just learn certain skills. We have to be very concrete about how we teach them. But again, not easy, man. Easier for me to be on my soapbox and say this, but just do your best. Do your best. Don't stop. And the fact, if you're listening to this all the way to the end here, you're a rock star. You're just a bona fide badass who wants the best for yourself. You want the best for your family. And I salute you dudes. So that's it. That was a lot of talking. If you like that, let me know. Honestly, give me feedback. If you thought it was shit, give me feedback. I'll continue with the interviews for sure. But if you like this, who knows? Maybe this is how we can rock and roll. Maybe it'd be cool to set up a 1-800 number and you could just call in your question. I could play them on the air. I think some fancy shows do that. Anyways, I digress. Cool. This was cool. This is something new that we did, that we tried. I freaking love your face. I love you. Thank you so much for supporting me and the show. I do know that I have a lot of champions out there. And if I didn't get a chance to read your question and you liked it, I'll just continue where I left off another time in the episode. So until then, keep kicking ass. You're a badass. I love your face, and I'll see you next week. So until then, we'll talk soon. Bye.